It was around 5 a.m, about an hour before sunrise, when Robin Garber opened his post office for the day in Melsonby, a small town in North Yorkshire.
It's a beautiful little village. I think there's about 700 residents or thereabouts, and it's beautiful. There's a church and a green, and the shop and post office that Robin and I ran was literally the hub of the village.
Robin runs the post office with his wife, Di.
And they were really popular in the village, and it was a successful business. The shop was doing really well. Di was very arty. She made cards and very good cook, and they were expanding the business, making sandwiches and lunches and cards. And
That's Jane Metcalf, a longtime friend of Robin's.
All in all, it was an idyllic lifestyle. Robin describes it as being like living on a set of Emmerdale.
And that particular morning, the 23rd of March in 2010, started just like any other for Robin and Di.
Robin woke at the usual time, about 4 o'clock in the morning, went downstairs, opened the shop at 4:30. He served customers from 4:30. It was a busy farming community, lots of stable boys. Would be coming in very early in the morning. Paperman came in, the milkman came in, just an ordinary day.
Robin worked in the post office all morning. At one point, Di shouted to him from the shop in the back. She didn't like to come out if she hadn't changed out of her pyjamas yet. After 3 hours of serving customers, Robin went back to the house where he and Di lived, which was above and behind the shop. Not long after that, Robin found Di lying dead on the bed in the spare room.
And he phoned the ambulance, 999.
The time of the call was 8:37 a.m.
The wife's been attacked.
And he couldn't turn Di over or something. Obviously he's hysterical.
No, he's gone.
When any
weapons
involved are mentioned.
So the operator on the telephone suggests he get help. So he left the phone on the side, he runs downstairs and he gets the next door neighbour who comes upstairs to help him and clearly dies, no longer alive.
Has your wife been shot?
So Robin's taken to the police station and he's then a witness, obviously. That's what he thinks, he's a witness. Of course, the big shot came 3 weeks later when Robin was arrested.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. Because the alternative is just too awful to imagine. We tell ourselves that victims like that of the post office scandal are unique and never try to imagine that they could happen to us or the people we love. But what if that isn't the case? What if cases like that are just a handful of many, many more and symbols of a much bigger problem with the justice system in this country? Every year, about 1,500 people write to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, claiming to be innocent. They are the only organisation with the power to send a case back to the Court of Appeal. But just 2% of those cases get sent back to the courts. And of the tiny number of wrongful convictions which are actually overturned, almost all are refused compensation. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Overturn. Today I'm in York to find out more about the case of Robin Garbutt, the postmaster convicted of his wife's murder, but who has always maintained his innocence.
I'm Jane Metcalf, a longtime friend of Robin Garbutt and campaigner. I knew Robin from friendship groups many, many years ago. We were all drinking buddies. He was in a long-term relationship with my friend, and we all used to socialise together. And then everyone parted ways as life changes and twists and turns of life, and I probably never would have seen Robin again, perhaps.
So what was Robin like back then when you first met him? How would you have described him?
Just really funny, gentle, a gentle soul, not loud, but quite a gentle lad, but very funny, very bright, always had a good job, always worked really hard.
Robin and Di bought the post office in Melsonby, North Yorkshire, back in 2007 and had been running it for 3 years. Robin worked out front serving customers while Di was the one who kept the books.
Robin and Di were really creatures of habit. They did the same thing week in, week out. On a Monday night, this was their routine. Robin would, in the afternoon, go to the cash and carry, top up with all the stock that they needed to buy, fill the car with all the stock, and then on the way home, drive home, pick up fish and chips, and then go home and have supper. While Di was plating up the fish and chips, he would bring in the expensive stock from the backyard. It was a tiny little backyard into the back of the post office. He'd bring the expensive stuff in while Di was preparing supper. And then on a Tuesday morning, he would go back outside in between serving customers and bring his stock back into the shop. And that's there were creatures of habit that happened every night.
On the morning of the 23rd of March, 2010, Robin woke at the usual time, 4 o'clock, to go and open the post office.
He served customers from 4:30.
We know this from the till roll for that morning, which shows an almost unbroken stream of transactions.
At 6:45, Robin heard Di call to him from the back of the shop, but if she was in her pyjamas, she wouldn't come into the shop. She would stay behind, you know, like the kitchen at the back of the shop. Very small area, by the way. This is a small little shop. And he heard Di call to him at 6:45, and she shouted to him, and he shouted, "Yeah, Di, in a minute, Di."
This was a moment brought up in court by a customer who was there that morning and had heard Di calling out to Robin at 6:45 a.m. The prosecution, however, argued that Diana was already dead by this point.
But then just continued to serve customers because it was busy. And I think he'd heard a knock, he'd heard a bang, but never thought anything of it. Thought it was just Di going into the bathroom. And then I think it was about 8:35, bearing in mind that the post office safes are on a major lock, you can't unlock them early. They're on a timer, a central timer. And Robin went into the little... So the post office kiosk is, like, within the shop. So he'd gone into the post office kiosk to sort the safe out, get the stamps out, stuff like that. And he heard the door click into the little post office, assumed it was Di, turned round, and it was a man with a balaclava on and a gun, and said, "Don't do anything stupid. We've got your wife." So Robin quickly loaded the bag up with money from the safe and the till, and the guy disappeared, you know, ran out the back door that he came in, and Robin just ran straight upstairs to their living quarters and ran into the bedroom and found Di face down, clearly in a... I don't know what he... I mean, I have no idea what he saw that day, but just will haunt him for the rest of his life, what he saw that day.
This was the second time the post office had been burgled in the space of a couple of years. The problem was that no one else actually saw the man in the balaclava. That said, a number of witnesses did tell police they had seen a blue car driving erratically around Melsonby on the morning of the murder. CCTV footage also showed a car following Robin in 8 different places in the course of his journeys to pick up stock the night before. That car had been sold by the end of the week. It took 2 days for police to find the metal bar that they identified as the murder weapon.
The murder weapon was said to be a metal bar, a rusty metal bar. Nobody ever doubted it was a murder weapon. In the courtroom, the judge follows the prosecution's lead and says that Robin, in the dead of night, after murdering his wife while she was sleeping in the cold, he crept downstairs in the dead of night and crossed the road and placed this metal bar on a wall that was over 8 feet high, this wall was. So that is actually the only thing that links Robin to the murder weapon. The fact that that's what the prosecution said. In the dead of night, you crept across the road and you placed the murder weapon on the top of the wall.
What's strange about this is why it took police 2 whole days to find the metal bar, considering how close it was positioned to the post office and bearing in mind that a full search of the village had been done on the day of the murder, the 23rd of March.
Although the wall was about 8.5 foot high from this side, from the side of the road, the other side, it dropped down, the land rose up to meet it, so it was only about 4 foot high, so you could look over the top of it. And a local has said that, you know, if that metal bar had been on the wall, it would have been seen, spotted, moved or whatever.
Jane says that on the day of the murder, there were cameramen standing on that wall, that people were sitting on it taking photographs, watching the events unfold, that there was no sign of a metal bar.
Because actually there's some CCTV footage emerged a long time after, which the camera pans along the top of the wall and on the 23rd and 24th of March, and there is no bar on the wall. It's not there.
Jane's referring to newly discovered unaired footage from Tyne Tees television, filmed after the murder but before the murder weapon was discovered on top of Nixon's garage boundary wall, which shows no metal bar where the police allegedly found it. The prosecution had argued at trial that it was unlikely that a fleeing burglar would have left the murder weapon behind and that Garbutt himself must have disposed of it there in the middle of the night.
There was DNA of Diana's on that murder weapon. And there was also DNA, a full DNA of a male. And they said initially, the forensics said, this was the DNA of the wielder, whoever had held this weapon when it was being used as a murder weapon. It was the person, that's who it belonged to, this DNA belonged to. Of course, it turned out it wasn't Robin's DNA. It was a full DNA. It was DNA of a police officer.
No concrete evidence has ever connected Robin Garbutt to the crime. No blood was found on his clothing. Forensic evidence did not link him to the metal bar.
The murder weapon was, crucial in the conviction of Robin, in the sense that the jury were told, Robin crept across the road and he laid it on the wall, despite no evidence, there's no DNA linking Robin to the murder weapon.
If there was no concrete evidence linking Robin to the crime, the prosecution must have presented quite a compelling case for him to have been convicted. So what was it? What was their story?
When Robin was first arrested and interviewed, surprisingly in the interviews, not only were the police there, but the post office were there. And Robin, in his naivety, said when he sat there, he thought, and he saw the post office were there, he thought they're here to defend me. You know, because they were running a really good shop, everything was really good, the business was really doing well. But it turns out that the post office, along with the police, insinuated that Robin had been stealing from the post office. And he didn't want Di to find out he'd been stealing, so that was his motive for murder. He killed her. Robin and Di were going on holiday about 2 weeks later. On the 23rd, they were supposed to be going away at the end of March for a 2 to 3 week holiday in America. Di's family were in America. So they had employed a temporary sub-postmaster to come in to run the shop while they were away, run the post office. And at that point, when somebody comes in, there's always an audit. Obviously, there's always an audit to see what the stamps are, what the cash is in the till, and etc. So the prosecution came up with a story that Robin was stealing from the post office. This audit, when the temporary sub-postmaster came in, would trip an audit and then his theft would be uncovered. He didn't want Di to find out, so he murdered her. The fact that Di was the postmistress and she did all the paperwork didn't seem to be relevant to them.
When it came to it, the jury wasn't able to reach a unanimous decision.
It was a 10-2 decision. The judge had initially said he wanted a full 12, but that they couldn't come up with a full 12. So then he said he would accept a majority vote.
Robin was sentenced to 20 years, life in prison. It's now 2025, 14 years after Robin Garbutt's initial trial. The post office scandal has exposed that more than 900 sub-postmasters were convicted of theft, fraud and false accounting based on data provided by their faulty IT system, Horizon. This information cast doubt on the prosecution's key motive for Robin killing his wife, that he was stealing from the post office.
The system that was used in Robin and I's post office was also Horizon. That had lots of problems with it. The helpline was completely useless when you had a problem with cashing up at night or whatever, or balancing. They didn't know what they were doing. So Robin and I were having exactly the same problems as what everybody else was. And as I say, one thing that was really striking was when Robin was first interviewed when he was arrested, the post office were in on those interviews, which was highly unusual. And so they obviously colluded with the police, I would think.
When I contacted North Yorkshire Police regarding this allegation, they said the facts surrounding this case had been set out during court proceedings, which resulted in Robin Garbutt being sentenced in 2011. We have nothing further to add.
There was no evidence to suggest that Robin had stolen a penny or die. Clearly, any evidence that came out of the post office is more than unreliable. It's actually corrupt. They were lies. So straight away, that post office expert, so-called, that convinced a jury that Robin was a thief and that was the motive to kill Diana. It's gone. It's fallen away completely. It no longer exists. They have no credibility, the post office. Anything that came out of their mouths, we know, no longer stands. And also the post office were asked, could they produce books that, you know, could they get the records that go back further than 2008, 2 years before the murder? And they said they couldn't. The paperwork didn't exist. The records didn't exist, which, of course, was not only untrue, it was a lie. The books did go back to 2003, we found out after trial, after it's all too late. And the books showed a pattern. Robin had kept and died, kept the books exactly the same. There's nothing any different. Had they had had those records been available and produced at trial, it would have put a very different story on this theft accusation for Robin. Absolutely 100% Robin is a victim of the post office scandal.
But the prosecution maintained that Garbutt was stealing money from the post office. According to them, he feared the consequences of a relief postmaster taking over whilst they were away in America and inevitably stumbling upon discrepancies in the accounts. He had invented the man in the balaclava, there were no eyewitnesses, and he hadn't pressed any of the post office's 4 panic buttons, as he ought to have done if there really had been a robbery. All this was supported by the expert evidence as to the time of death. Initially, the police and prosecution had suggested that Diana had still been alive at 6:45, but at trial they changed their tune. Rigor mortis and hypostasis in Diana's body apparently suggested that she had been killed sometime before 8:45, but experts found it hard to be more specific. Heavy reliance was placed on one expert's analysis of the contents of her stomach, the partially digested meal of fish and chips, which estimated the time of death as between 2:30 and 4:30. This, the prosecution argued, contradicted Robin's version of events. After being convicted, Robin had one opportunity to appeal the decision. He brought up issues of non-disclosure by the post office, arguing that they had access to important evidence which could have proved that he wasn't stealing from them, and therefore destroy the prosecution's motive for murder.
They had evidence to suggest that the post office knew that they had records that went back to 2003 that would have completely defended Robin, that there was no skullduggery going on with the books, everything was normal. So that's what they went back to the Court of Appeal with. However, the Court of Appeal didn't see it. They said they didn't feel the jury convicted on theft. They think the jury convicted on time of death. The appeal system doesn't stack up. The appeal system doesn't do what we the general public think it does. It doesn't protect anybody who's innocent. It does the opposite, really. It keeps you locked away. And you are, going back to what the appeal system, you are totally on your own. There is no help.
A number of issues of police negligence have also cast doubt on Robin Garbutt's conviction. Even at the time of the judge's summing up to jury at trial, he recognised that the police had shown a quote-unquote regrettable lack of professionalism at the crime scene.
It was a comedy of errors. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny.
For example,
on the bed where Diana was laid, at the side of her head, was a clump of hair. You can see it on the photographs. They showed it on the big screen in the courtroom. Robin had very short grey hair, so it couldn't have been Robin's. Diana had very long, dark hair. So it wasn't Diana's. It was somebody had mid-length, medium brown hair, I think. And that hair was lost. We don't know whether it was bagged and recorded, but it was lost. It was seen, a huge piece of evidence, you know? And clearly this hair, had it been bagged, would have maybe matched the DNA on the murder weapon and the crime scene. But of course it was lost.
If the clump of hair was pulled from the assailant's head, it means a chance to obtain a DNA profile was thrown away, and with it a chance for Garbutt to clear his name. The prosecution claimed at trial this didn't matter because there was no sign of a struggle. However, a bedside lamp and mirror had been knocked over, and a neighbour summoned by Garbutt after he raised the alarm said that she had picked up pictures which fell to the floor. What's more, fresh evidence such as the analysis of Diana's stomach contents, which was said to be capable of pinpointing the time of death, has been called into question and challenged on numerous occasions.
And so, of course, once you fail at appeal, and many, many, many people have had their convictions overturned, have all had to go through appeal. Once you fail at appeal, then your only route back to the Court of Appeal is through the Criminal Case Review Commission, the CCRC.
Mm-hmm. And how many applications to the CCRC has Robin had?
Robin's now on his fourth. So the first application went in 2012, and we're now on the fourth. But for anyone who doesn't obviously understand the application process, with every application you have to find new and fresh evidence. You're not just hammering off the same, rewording the same application. So with each application, the bar gets higher and higher because you have to find new and fresh evidence that was not available at trial. So for example, at trial, people have what they call an unused bundle, which is evidence that maybe the defence team didn't feel was relevant to use at that time, but it might be used further down the line, for example. If there's anything in that unused bundle that's really relevant to your case, but it wasn't used, but it was available to be used, you're not allowed to use it. It can't be used in your defence, which is unbelievably shocking to think. There could be something in that unused bundle, something really strong to support your claim of innocence. You're not allowed to use it because the CCRC will say it was available at trial. You didn't use it. You can't use it now. I have a completely different view of the criminal justice system, though. As I said to you earlier, that I always thought when they're just not getting it, the CCRC, just not understanding what we're saying, you know, we need to word it in a different way or spell it out a little bit simpler. We don't know who they are. Are they lawyers? We don't know who the people are that are reading these applications. And I was under that illusion for a while that they're just not getting it. It's okay, we'll just keep that. We'll just keep going and we'll just explain it in a different way. We'll put it in a different format. Until I don't know when the penny dropped, but then the penny dropped quite some time ago that I realise now that they're not out to help us, no matter what they tell you they are to want to do. They're not. When they take forever to make a decision, it's intentional. They're hoping you'll go away. They're hoping you'll lose interest. They're hoping you might die. Something will happen to you and you don't turn, you know, you can't do it anymore. Because it is really, really hard to keep going is when every where you go, you meet a brick wall.
A CCRC spokesperson said, an application has been received in relation to this case and a review is underway. It would be inappropriate to comment any further while the review is ongoing. Jane says that in hindsight, Robin should have immediately gone to one of the best lawyers in London. But as there was no evidence linking him to the crime, they didn't even think the case would get to trial.
There was no evidence against him. And in the early months, we didn't even think he'd get into a courtroom because there was nothing on him. There was nothing that linked him to it. There was no motive. Because saying that he's killed his wife because he's been stealing from the post office makes no sense at all. It was their business. You know, it was his post office. None of it made any sense at all. So many people didn't think it would even get to trial. And he's been in prison, more or less, give or take, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he's how old now?
He'll be coming up 60 in August. He was in his mid-40s. You can't believe it, can you? He was mid-40s. And I think the hardest thing for Robin, not only obviously being locked away from his family and missing huge milestones in all his loved ones' lives, it's die. You know, the thought that his, well, it's not the thought, the fact is, Diana, whoever murdered Diana, walked free that day. So the hardest thing for Robin is the violent death. What did she feel? What did she see? What happened to her that terrible day? She's obviously put up a fight with whoever, and she was that kind of person. So when Robin was convicted, he went to a high security, I don't know the categories, Franklin Prison in Durham. And it's high security, they have lots of terrorists there, and Ian Huntley and people like that are there. They have a prison within a prison there. It's top security. And then I think it's probably about 3 years ago, I've lost track of times, when he moved to Wealston Prison in Wetherby. And it was the first time since he was convicted that he'd seen autumn. Because in Franklin, you can't see anything. There was nothing to see. There was no, you know, that you couldn't look out onto the world, a street, or anything, nothing like that. Whereas at Wealston, he, from his room, he can actually see trees and fields. And he said, when he moved there, how incredible it was to watch autumn. You can't imagine that, can you, not seeing the trees change colour? But where he is now, yeah, he can see the trees. He can watch autumn and the summer, and watch all the trees come off, and all the trees turn the leaves change colour. And that's just, it's just, nobody can imagine it, can they?
It's hard to sum up all of the evidence that Jane presented to me in our few hours together, and afterwards over email. Article after article, letter after letter. The list really is endless. In her view, there is nothing that still stands from that original trial. What is clear is that if the prosecution case was brought today, it would be substantially weaker than it was back in 2011. Robin Garbutt's case is one of several hundred currently before the CCRC. Very few ultimately succeed in persuading commissioners that they should refer a case to the Court of Appeal. While he waits to hear whether his case will be in that small number, Robin Garbutt continues to serve his life sentence. He is likely to be in his late 60s before his release is even considered. In the next episode, we look at the case of a group of men jailed for life for planning a terrorist attack after being caught in an undercover police sting.
Telling someone that your brother is a convicted terrorist when deep down you know that he's not done any crime, it's very difficult to have that conversation.
This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.